Claire Parker.
And I'm Ashley Hamilton.
And this is Celebrity Memoir Book Club,
the podcast where we open up the book of texts and relay it to you like a pastor. Instead of the Book of Mormon or the Book of Jesus, this week we're talking about the Book of Jose. And if you don't like our interpretation, our sermon, if you will, you can actually go somewhere else.
I will say, often people hatefully say, I love the concept for this pod, but hate these two women. There are other people who do exactly this.
Yeah.
And I hope you find your bliss.
If you hate us, there is just simply no reason to be here. But if you like us, oh boy, do I appreciate you. And I thank our 5-star reviewers at the end of every episode.
And Ashley.
Yes, Claire?
Do you have any news for the people?
I do. Okay, so we are traveling. We're traveling the globe, but mostly just this chunk of area. We're going to be in Austin, Texas for the Moon Tower Comedy Festival on April 18th. That's coming up really quick, so don't miss it. My entire family will be there. They were not invited. We will be in Tampa, Florida and Fort Lauderdale, Florida in May. And we will be coming to Columbus, Ohio and Charlotte, North Carolina, but those dates have been rescheduled.
Yes, at no fault of our own.
It is not our fault. It is someone's specific's fault. We just can't say who.
We've been told specifically we can't talk about it here. But a little bit of Googling, you'd figure it out real quick. I'm so sorry. I was hoping that I would be able to tell you guys with new dates, but we're looking at mid-June. We will keep you abreast. And genuinely, we are so sorry. We were so excited. I hope I haven't inconvenienced anybody. I hope if you weren't able to make May, this is actually good news.
Yeah.
And we'll see you when it's cooking warm.
Well, I can't wait to cook something warm in Columbus, Ohio, my favorite city in America.
And smashy.
Yes, Claire?
Okay. What story from this week do you think would make your memoir?
Okay. I think I learned a valuable exercise in restraint this week.
No way.
Yeah. Okay. So it was St. Patrick's Day, right? So spoiler alert, we don't always record these the day you're hearing them. It was St. Patrick's Day this weekend, and I was walking to meet some friends for a pint of Guinness just to have a little celebratory moment. And I was walking past this bar, and they were blasting U2 out the door. And I thought to myself, ugh, maybe I should cancel on my friends and just go here, right? And then these two guys walking behind me were like, should we go into that bar? And then the other guy goes, no, they're playing U2. That band sucks. I'm not going in there.
This is the opposite of a meet cute, or is it like the meet cutest?
It wasn't the meet cutest. It was just one of those things where I was walking and I was thinking about saying something because you know me, I love a public confrontation. And then I thought, Ashley, keep your mouth shut. And then they went on to riff for about a block about how much they hate you two. And then one of them goes, they do rock in concert though. And the other one was like, what? And then he goes, yeah, you know, I saw them in concert and it was the best concert I've ever seen. So now I'm just walking a direction I don't need to go because I don't want to lose this conversation and I'm in front of them. So I'm just hoping I anticipate correctly and then front leading your move.
That's what actually, yeah, I'll get into it on the Patreon. That's my number one move.
Anyway, so then I'm walking and I'm hearing them hash it out. And then he starts like singing the concert he saw. And the guy was like, did you go to the Sphere? And he's like, no, I saw them at U2 360, which for those of you who don't know is like 15 years ago. And he was just like singing what he heard at the concert. He was like singing in his best Bono impression. And he really worked it out for himself that he actually doesn't hate you two. And then I was like, you know what, Ashley? Why do you confront people when no fucking idiot on this earth has any idea what they're talking about?
One thing about men is about 50% of them will figure it out eventually if you let them just keep going.
But even if they don't, they don't even know what they're saying. They're just saying stuff to sound cool to their buddies and nobody knows anything. So don't interject when it's not your business.
I love that.
Claire, what story from your week would make it into your memoir?
I guess like nothing really that interesting has happened. I'm still on my failure grind. I'm 3 weeks into pottery. Either I am the worst potter in class or the best because everybody else is like making vases and bowls and cups. And I don't know if I haven't made anything because I'm the worst or because my standards are the highest and I keep demolishing everything I try. Yeah, I got nothing. I got nothing to show for myself. I'm going to come out with like one single mug.
The most expensive mug.
The most expensive. And we are living in a world full of expensive mugs.
Oh my God. I went to an art fair recently and there was the most beautiful mugs and they were all between like $70 and $100. And I was like, okay.
They probably made them once a week at this class I went to. That's about what we're aiming for. I was saying that to Mac and Mac goes, no, I know you worked really hard at something recently and you completed it. And I was like, what? He goes, Well, the other day you were doing something and you worked so hard at it and you finished. And I was like, oh my God, are you talking about when I reset my Facebook password? And he was. That was very difficult, though. I did spend 2 hours on it.
I know. And you really talked about it like the rest of the day.
Well, I completed a very tricky task. But I'm on to my newest project. I'm a mother of a 3-day-old sourdough starter. We're feeding it for the first time tonight at 8 p.m. So stay tuned. And I'm feeling good so far. It's bubbly and gurgly, just like it said it would be online. And you know what? If in 10 days it turns out it's toxic, we just try again.
Is that what could happen? It could become toxic?
I mean, how toxic does fermented get? Is fermented mold?
I guess at worst, it just turns into like a
wine, kombucha.
Yeah, a whiskey of sorts.
I don't think old bread could kill you.
I can't wait for it to become like your Stregonona moment where the sourdough takes control of your home.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. It's like Frankenstein.
I'm excited for it.
I'm so proud of it, watching it grow.
I'm excited to visit your house for some dough.
Well, I'm on the way up, but this week's memoirist is all the way up. It's none other than Fat Joe, his words not mine, The Book of Jose, a memoir.
Okay, so one thing that I want to say about this book.
I hope you have an entire episode worth of things you want to say about this book, because we've probably got another 80 minutes of talking to go.
You know what? I'll dig deep. I'll dig deep and see if I can yammer. The first thing is that we were actually invited to the release party for this book like a year and a half ago, but we like lost the DM inviting us and we couldn't figure out like where it was or what day it was. And so we didn't go. So then when he was talking about his big night performing at the Apollo, I was like, oh, wow, that would have been a really full circle moment to witness. Too bad we didn't.
But we couldn't have known it back then because we hadn't read the book yet.
Totally. The second thing I wanted to talk about is the way this book is written. So there is a co-writer. It's written by Fat Joe and Shaheem Reed. I'm sure it's Fat Joe's voice. Like, it's so true to tone because I don't know him personally, but I'm assuming he talks this way.
Like when he's on the phone.
He sounds just like when we chat in the mornings. But no, it's just like such a specific way of speaking that it was really well done in that, like, I don't know that the story has a complete through line, but boy, oh boy, do I feel like I got to know him.
Can I say something about this book?
Yeah.
Is this our opportunity to just say real quick what we think before we get into what we think?
Yeah.
Finally, an opportunity to speak. This book does one of my favorite book things, which is it has an about the type page at the end.
That's not what I thought you were going
to
say.
I love when books take a minute to acknowledge the font they've chosen.
Okay.
And then I was wondering, do books ever not choose the same font? And I went through a bunch of books the other day trying to compare and contrast fonts.
Is that why we had to start an hour later than usual?
No, this was actually a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
I've actually been on quite a font kick.
Okay.
So in case you're wondering at home, this book was set in Caslon, a typeface first designed in 1722 by William Caslon.
Oh, I would love to just name a font after myself.
It's considered a workhorse typeface due to its pleasant open appearance, while the italic is exceedingly decorative.
You know what? There was an interesting use of italics in this book, and I found it fancy.
It is exceedingly decorative. Anyway, I guess now we get to the book. I'm going to give it another piece of credit here.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
I don't mind.
You know, we often have problems with, or not problems, but we like to poke fun, make note of people who have an author's note, a preface, an intro. The other day we read a book that had 2 chapters in the preface before part 1, chapter 1. This book opens chapter 1, just like throws you right in the middle. The streets crown me the realest walking the earth. I earned it. Motherfuckers have been trying to kill me my entire life one way or the other. I've been shot multiple times in front of my mother. When I was 10, a grown man named Papi Loco wrongfully accused me of trying to kill his infant daughter by throwing batteries off the roof and pummeled me until I was bloody and had a concussion. When I was a young teen, a street don tried to scare me to death by threatening to stick my entire arm into a meat grinder. The police have done their best to beat me into oblivion. When that didn't work, crooked cops tried to frame me for murder so I could do life in prison. Through it all, though, I never folded. Now that's the way to start a fucking chapter one.
That's a way to launch a book, man. My name is Fat Joe, a.k.a. Joey Crack, a.k.a. Joe Pratt, a.k.a. the Don Cartagena.
Born on August 19th, 1970 at the Bronx Lebanon Hospital. The South Bronx, to be exact, an auspicious and ominous birthplace.
So he says his history with violence started as soon as he got out of the womb. So his mom was married before his mom met his dad and had 2 children.
To actually Angel Cartagena, who was not his biological father, but because they were legally married, Fat Joe took the last name Cartagena.
Ruby, his mom, was married to Angel, had two sons and a daughter. Then when Angel went to jail, started dating Ernesto and stayed with him for the rest of time, but never actually divorced Angel.
Ernesto had a big heart. My father busted his ass to provide for us. He was a baker. He was a carpenter. He taught me what it meant to be relentless. But he was still kind of an alcoholic. And they went up and down.
His mom and Angel Sr. never officially divorced. And so when Fat Joe was born, Angel came around and said he was going to kill this baby. People were threatening his life from kind of day one.
Also growing up, he was the youngest kid in his family. His dad actually had 9 kids and a wife back in Cuba. They don't really get referenced too much for the rest of the book. He was from a huge family. They didn't have a lot of money. And he says, my grandmother would have 50 grandkids, 50 of us running around, but I would be the only one under the table. My reputation as the family black sheep preceded me. So at the gatherings, my family didn't even give me a chance to get in trouble. They kept me on lockdown as a precaution. So this obviously gave him a chip on his shoulder that he was already considered the bad kid before he had ever even done anything. But he also says it gave him a chance to learn because he was always just under the table in the kitchen. He learned about all the family gossip and he heard about the way alcohol, drugs, gambling, cheating brought down a lot of his family members. And he kind of grew up quick. I feel like he's a big believer that you can learn from other people's mistakes.
Yeah, and he swore off a lot of stuff really early just because he saw the effect it had on his family. He never smoked cigarettes. He was very wary of drugs and alcohol. His grandpa drank a lot of alcohol, loved Bacardi, and so he at one point made $500,000 doing a Bacardi commercial, and he was like, that was revenge for what they did to my family.
So early on, he was a bigger kid, and he was really smart. Those were his two main qualities. They had these classes in my school called IGC, which stood for Intellectually Gifted Kid. Yeah, I was a badass, but I was also an intellectual. Every year in that class, I was competing to get the most awards. I'd get close, but got beat out every time.
Then he goes to junior high, and that is where he kind of enters the streets. He discovers graffiti, and that was his first passion. And him and his friends graffiti the shit out of as much as they can.
To the point where, like, the cops were pissed. He says at one point he turned on New York One, which is the local news channel, and there was Rudy Giuliani standing in front of his graffiti tag being like, we must stop these children. Who is doing this?
And it was him.
We'd walk on the side of the tracks from train station through the tunnels. Fuck the third rail or oncoming train. Shit was crazy, but that's just how it was. We did it for the culture. It is crazy to think about a time when graffiti was genuinely considered a huge crime.
Yeah.
Now it's so accepted as an art form that even though it is technically a misdemeanor or illegal, whatever, it's hard to think that you'd be up late at night worried your child's graffitiing.
Well, it's also now people like pay for it. Yeah. People are like, oh, we need like some good graffiti on the side of this coffee shop.
He also said part of the problem with graffiti is that you weren't a real graffiti artist if you had paid for your spray paints. So they were also all doing petty theft. Can I ask something stupid?
Of course.
The third rail, is that real?
I don't know. I've never touched it. I have an addictive personality. I love to rap. I want to be the best. I've made a million songs. When I hustled, I had to hustle and take over everything. Graffiti was the same. I didn't know how to stop.
Eventually, my graffiti got me kicked out of the JHS 120 after about a year. Then I got kicked out of 6 more junior high schools across the Bronx. Schools kept saying, we've got your name here, Joe. You got thrown out of the last school for graffiti and it says you wrote crack all over the walls. Now our school has crack all over the walls and you gotta go.
That's so funny.
Also, so his first nickname was Joey Crack. He's like, crack didn't even exist yet. Like, that was not the drug of choice. He was called Joey Crack because he was a 400-pound 10-year-old. And
you
his
could
pants
see his butt crack
often didn't go up all the way. So he was Joey Crack.
He also is like constantly getting into conflicts. A lot of people want to fuck him up. And so he is at this school where a big group of people decide they hate him. And every single day they would just like beat the living daylights out of him. Because it's just him and the rest of these kids at this junior high school, he always got the shit kicked out of him because it's usually just a numbers game.
So he says he grew up in a mostly black neighborhood. So even though he is Puerto Rican and Latino, he like identified with the black kids. But then when he went to this other school, they hadn't grown up with him. So he was like the only Latino kid in the class. This happened for about 2 years, bullied literally every day, getting beat up by 24 guys. Sometimes they'd get extra petty and spit on me or put gum in my hair. It was hard to go to school, but I knew I couldn't let my family down again after getting thrown out of practically every other school in the Bronx.
He had a best friend named Leonard, and Leonard and him would hang out every day. And then one day the kids at school were like, stop hanging out with him. And then he was like, oh, okay. And then he like joined the other kids in beating the shit out of him. He had been like a brother to me and he betrayed me with no problem. That's still one of the most traumatizing memories in my life. At that point, for all my black sheep tendencies, I was still just a clever kid, just a year from being in the gifted class, obsessed with rapping and graffiti. So he takes betrayal very seriously. I will say, I think most of these kids are just sensitive. They're sensitive and then sometimes they shoot people.
When he says his friend Leonard turned on him, that was my Anakin Skywalker moment. My turn to the dark side. Outside of my immediate family and a few friends, I felt the whole world was against me. Well, my body would repair itself from the physical trauma in time, my mental scars were cut deeper and beyond repair.
I don't care about human life no more, I told myself. I don't give a fuck. Anybody who ever fronts on me, I'm going to give it to him. I'm going to rob them. I'm going to beat up whoever. I'm going to victimize anybody breathing. That was the initial rebirth of Joey Crack. So he gets really big on violence. This is also around the time when he's like exiting junior high, going into high school-ish, that he discovers music. There's this guy, KRS-One, who sings a song called South Bronx. He thinks it's great. It plants a little seed in his head, but at that point, it doesn't do much else.
But at this point, it's like the 80s, and so rap music and hip-hop is still underground, and he's listening to all of these kind of like local celebrities at the block parties and stuff, and it's very neighborhood-based.
It's really inspiring. He says it's borough pride set to music. It's cool to see someone become like a local celebrity and to have everyone in the neighborhood like celebrating them.
One thing he does in this book that I think speaks to why he is so successful and why he is ultimately very liked is he takes a lot of pages in this book to give credit where credit is due to other people. So he spends 3 pages describing KRS and his come up and his hits and the way he went about the business and why he loves his music so much. And I mean, throughout the whole book, and then at the end, it's just like chapter after chapter after chapter of other people's legacies and who he respects and who's good at what. And he's very quick to call somebody a genius. He's very quick to call somebody like brilliant, a mentor. Even people younger than him, he's like, I recognize right away later down the road, Big Pun, that he was going to be the one of us that broke out. He has no problem recognizing other people's talent and greatness. And I think that that's why he goes on to be successful and why people like him.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of those god-awful startup CEOs that micromanage everything and are like, I have to write all the tweets and I have to do all the Instagrams and I have to package everything.
I know which one you're talking about.
But at the end of the day, low-key, it's all of them.
I know. It is all of them, but it is also my ex-bosses specifically.
But it's all of your ex-bosses.
It is many of my ex-bosses.
And there is that mentality now that like you're the only one who can do anything. And people don't like feeling that way. And I think why Fat Joe has had such longevity and why, as we see later, he's well respected in like different neighborhoods and in different cultures is because he's happy to lift up fellow people and he's happy to like recognize.
We got an email recently from a fellow podcaster who just like took some time out to tell us something so kind. And like when people just compliment you and recognize that you're trying, you're like, oh, I'll die for you.
Yeah. So he's going to all these block parties and he's loving it. And his older brother's introducing him to this music. His older brother's named Angel Jr., June, sometimes they call him. When going to most of these functions, partying was the last thing on my mind. Instead, I would roll through the park with my band of thieves and rob as many people at the jams as we could. We'd yoke up the people who were there to dance and fuck up the whole party. The DJs would see us wild and stop the music, and we'd just go through the party a cappella, beating up anybody in our path. That's how the Terror Squad initially got our rep.
So he forms a little crew called the Terror Squad, Joey Crack and the Terror Squad.
Joey Crack, that name became so legendary. In my age group of young teenagers, my name became one of the most notorious in the entire Bronx. And then they just start going fucking crazy. And okay, I will say one thing I would like to fact check Joey Crack on. Joe the Don, Fat Joe, whatever you know him as, the Book of Jose, is the way that he'll be like, we were rolling 100 deep, 100 men. He's always with 100 people. He's like, me and 100 guys showed up to jump a child. And I'm like, 100, that's the size of my wedding. What do you mean you were just running around town with a pack of 100?
I mean, he talks about being 100 deep to like go to school. And I'm like, how many people even went to your school?
He really is. He'll be like, 100 of us got on the school. No, 100 of you did not get on the school bus. And he'll be like, there was tons of them, 50, 100. I'm like,
even later in the book, he's like, we would never go to the club without 50 people with us.
I'm like, what are you talking about, 50? How many cars is that?
I went to a bar last weekend. There was 11 of us, and I had an absolute panic attack on the sidewalk being like, we're never going to get into a bar with 11 people.
It's just, I mean, how do you get out the door? You ever try to rally a bachelorette party? That's just too many people. 100. What do you mean you were avoiding the cops with 100 of you? That's a parade, my friend. You can't be on a violent parade.
We were wildin' and the streets were talking. Hold on, this is just funny. One day I was on Cortland Avenue chasing a guy who owed me money, and it just so happened that we ran by George, and George yells out, who is you? And they're yelling, and he goes, I'll kill your whole fucking family. At the time, I was at an age where I hadn't yet heard people regularly threatening to kill other people's families. His words shocked me.
We have to laugh because like the amount of violence and death he saw growing up, I like don't even know how you survive something like that.
Oh, me either.
I guess statistically, most of them didn't.
Like the amount of people who come out of this not in jail
How could you?
I don't know.
I was just kept thinking about him as the therapist in J-Lo's movie being like, Fat Joe, do you know you have trauma too? Like, I like just want to be like, you need to know what you went through is not normal. And if you need someone to talk to, later he says he has a huge team and like he's got this barber that he loves. And sometimes when he's going through shit, the barber sits down with ice cream on the couch and they talk it out. And I'm like, I'm so happy you have a friend like that. Maybe all you need is a barber. All you need is a good barber and a tub of ice cream. You can kind of get through whatever. But if you need someone else, Joe, you've been through a lot. I love this. I've always been a leader. I never knew anything but leadership. You'd see me with 10 other kids and I'd be the one calling the shots. Don't ask me why. That's how I was born and raised. It might be the Leo in me. And I'm like, back away from Jennifer Lopez.
You are talking to Jennifer too much. She doesn't know what astrology is.
Were you shocked by how little she came up in this book?
We'll get to it later, but...
She doesn't even have a chapter, right?
No. Oh, baby. Classic Clashlight game nights are better than ever thanks to Exploding Kittens. Exploding Kittens makes the most incredible games for elevating your every experience. Ariana Grande even one time played Poetry for Neanderthals on TikTok. The games are incredible for ages 7 and up, but also the perfect game for groups of adults. Especially this one, Poetry for Neanderthals, the Not Safe for Work edition. If you want to get a game, go to explodingkittens.com/celebrity for 25% off. You can also use the code celebrity at explodingkittens.com. Or explodingkittens.com/celebrity, where it'll be automatically applied. Claire, should we game?
Oh my gosh, yes. I'm so excited. I'm going on vacation in June with another couple, and I'm excited to bring these.
For a little NSFW
okay,
game night?
Okay, this stressed me out, because you know I'm a prude and a half, and so this is just like the game we played last time called Poetry for Neanderthals, except for this time it's Not Safe for Work, and oof.
Saucy.
It's saucy. Are you ready?
I'm scared. Okay, I'm excited.
So Poetry for Neanderthals gives you little phrases that you score points when you get the other person to guess those phrases, but you can only use one syllable words.
Okay.
I have two words. First word is juice that come out of me.
Come?
No.
Sweat?
No.
Saliva?
No.
Tears?
No. Hold on, let me think of another way to describe it. I don't know. There's only one word I can think of, but it's two syllables. Sit and turn on sync so you can't hear me.
P?
Yes. And then the second word is stick. Use it to stick things. Things stick. Stick things. Use it to stick things.
Glue?
No.
Not
glue.
Tape?
Yes.
Pee tape?
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
You guys, you've got to go to explodingkittens.com/celebrity for 25% off the fun that your next game night requires. Okay, so he has this group called the Terror Squad. And so he is going to his first day of high school and he has like developed a reputation. And he hasn't seen the kids from the middle school that used to beat him up in a little bit. And so he's going to roll up to high school with this crew that like they don't even know he has. So he rolls up to high school like 100 deep and this fight breaks out because they're like, who are you? How do you have a crew now? And so like his crew is fighting this other crew. And then he like almost gets chased down by this guy. And then another kid comes out from like the alley and beats this guy down. And he's like, who are you? And he's like, I'm Joey Crack, T.S. And that's the thing that I wanted to get to. It's so funny that he has like a little MBA.
Yeah, they all represent TS Terror Squad.
And he goes, can I be Raul TS? And he goes, yeah, you can be Raul TS. And Raul is one of his best friends to this day.
So he talks about growing up. Me and my dad, Ernest, were sometimes cool, but we weren't tight. I moved out of the family house when I was 14. And a major reason, besides wanting to sell drugs in peace, was that I couldn't get along with my father. We'd butt heads. He says my father would work all week. Sometimes he would gamble, lose all his money. And then at 4 a.m. start yelling at my mom to make him food. Sometimes if the steak tasted a little too salty to him, he'd throw the plate of food against the wall. But he eventually beat his alcoholism. But even now, we still get into it. I pay every bill in his and my mother's house. But when we get into arguments, he goes for the throat. He tells me if it weren't for a rap, I'd be a drug dealer. He tells me I wasn't shit. But on the other side, my son Joey was born with Down syndrome and he's autistic. His mother abandoned him the day he was born. It would have all been left on me, but my mother and father stepped up. They're the ones who really raised Joey so I could have a career. Of course, financially, I always provided, and I was always in my son's life. But if it wasn't for them, taking care of Joey would have consumed my life too, and I never would have had a career. Little Joey to this day sleeps in the same bed with my father. They get up together, spend the whole day together. For many years now, my wife and I have been asking my parents to give us Joey, but they won't. My father takes care of that boy and cooks and cleans for my mother. My father long ago crossed over from being a bad guy to a good one. So there's a redemption story for you. And I was like, damn.
That is quite a redemption story.
There's a fucking redemption story for you.
That's very sweet. We learn a little bit more about little Joey later.
So he just talks about he starts hanging out with this guy, C, who's a bit older than them, and is the first person to introduce a gun to the mix. And it's one thing to be able to fight 100 v 100, fist v fist. But when somebody shows up with a gun, they win. This was around the time when not everybody just had guns. Or I don't know if it was like the timing or if it was the fact that he was 13, 14. And most 13, 14-year-olds don't just like have guns. But he gets a gun and they start really getting into the drug deal.
Yeah, they're dealing drugs, him and his best friend Tone. And at one point he gets caught up by this kingpin who brings him into the back of a deli and threatens to put his arm in a meat grinder. And then just like takes sympathy on him because they're like, you didn't know that that was my corner. He has a lot of lucky breaks. Like, he gets unlucky a couple times, but my God, not getting his hand meat grinded off.
This was 1984 when the crack epidemic really started hitting. The number of addicts in our community exploded and there was money to be made. Tone and I already had respect in the projects. Now we wanted to turn that juice into money. So they just like start using a bunch of kids to hustle and they take over corners. They're like acting insane. He's got cars. He's got homes. They're doing like thousands of dollars a day in drugs. And he's like 15, 16. They're just walking around with guns, sticking people up, robbing whoever.
We had no fear of anyone stepping to us. We had no fear of the police, rivals, nothing. We just walked around. We were looking for anybody who wanted problems. Nobody wanted it.
At some point, somebody goes, yo, see, I got about 200 motherfuckers outside. I told him, 200? That's too many. No 15-year-old has an army of 200.
This was before cell phones. How do you gather 200 people?
There's just no way.
Our hustling on the corners expanded. We started to get bread, and soon our friends saw how we were coming up and forgot all about the youth job program. So they recruit some people out of, you know, like Scared Straight and Dare.
Not even. I guess there was a program up there that helped kids get like legit summer jobs.
Oh.
And even his brother later is working on Wall Street, making a couple hundred dollars a day. And he gets recruited out by some giant drug dealer being like, why would you do that if you can make thousands of dollars a day? But the problem is, it's not sustainable. You can't live your life.
He knows so many people who had millions and millions of dollars in like shoe boxes and just lost it all in one fell swoop.
The problem was that whether it was guns, drugs, or sex, the world didn't care that we were just kids and we didn't know better. How could we? When you're young, thugging and chasing paper, just about every day is filled up with adrenaline.
Oh my God, there's this one crazy story. So there's this guy named Howie who used to get shot all the time. All in all, he got shot 13 different times. Not 13 different bullet wounds, he got shot 13 different occasions. And at one point, he goes into the hospital because he got shot. And there's a rumor that Joey Crack is the one who shot him. So this guy comes looking for Joey to kill him and like is chasing him around with guns. He's like haunting this guy. And Fat Joe is like, who is this kid that I like cannot escape? And it turned out all to be misinformation. They forgive each other. And of course, he has to beat the kid up. But it is crazy. Like all of these stories.
Mind you, I'm doing all this scrambling, but I was really Fat Joe at the time. I was crazy overweight. I can't believe I didn't catch a fucking heart attack. I was gasping for air. Breathing like Darth fucking Vader. Me and Tone, we hid under the turtle. All we heard was car tire screeching. I don't know what it was about those days, but the cops were never there when you needed them. He has like this beef with this one cop who's out to get him. And at one point, a younger cop trying to impress him shows up to the projects where Joe lives. Six cops. And the guy's like, look, I'm taking my badge off. I'm taking my gun off. Let's just like settle this. You and me, man to man, one on one, fist to fist. And Joey's like, oh, well, you're fucked. I'm going to beat the shit out of you. So they start fighting, then all the cops jump him and they're like, did you really think we were just gonna let you go one on one? No, it's 6-1. One thing about this book is I'm like, what do the cops do?
Oh, nothing. He goes into the one time that he was suicidal. So he had a different dad than his three siblings. And at one point, his brother is talking about what to do with his money that he's earned from drug dealing. And his two older brothers, Raymond and Angel, are discussing it and Joey's there. And then Raymond was like, don't listen to Joey. He's not even our full brother. And it sends him over the edge. It's like the meanest thing anyone's ever said to him because he's like, we were all full brothers. He like drives away. He almost drives 100 miles an hour into a wall. And then at the last second, he decides not to. I never had a suicidal thought again through all the obstacles. I've gone through making money and then going broke and trying to make money again, going to jail, getting robbed by one of my best friends and watching another die. Through all the pressure, I never thought about killing myself again. I eventually understood the reason I was scared to die. I love life too much. It really fucked with him, though, because he says home was his sanctuary. Like, out on the streets, he had to be Joey Crack. He had to run shit. And at home is where he felt safe. And then for his brother to say that, there are a couple things, just random comments and conversations that have fucked him up for decades. Okay, so then there's this thing called the numbers game. And this is the underground lottery, basically. And his family is very involved in both playing and losing money in the numbers game, but also running numbers games. His grandpa ran 47 locations. And so watching this, like watching his family lose so much money in this numbers game and like also make a ton of money in this numbers game, but like have it never really be consistent. He was like, I'm never going to gamble. He had no interest in it. He also had no interest in weed because he had a really bad trip one time. Like the one time he got high, he was with this girl and then he like ended up running through the streets naked because he was scared. He thought once again that he was going to catch a heart attack. I'm going to catch a heart attack, I yelled, running down my block, ass out. I'm going to die. Dude, he is a great writer. I'm sorry. Everything is so funny and it's not funny.
So then he talks about his brother, Angel Cartagena Jr., my big brother, my first idol. Angel's the one who introduced me to hip hop. So when he was young, Angel really wanted to be a rapper himself, and he's the one who introduced Joey to it. And then later he got addicted to drugs. He first started with PCP, which apparently it seems like a really horrible thing to see somebody be on. Like he remembers the first night his brother came home high and his mom had to give him a bath and give him milk, and all the parents from the hallway came to try to help. And he's like, nobody can do PCP every day. You'll just die.
No one really should do it ever, actually.
Yeah. That night changed all of our lives. He would have issues with drugs for a long time, especially with that dust. But eventually he gets clean and he goes, as I said, to work on Wall Street. And somebody comes up to him, a guy named Danny, and says, why are you working downtown for $300 a week when you can make $500 a day with me? All you have to do is stand out there and be a lookout. The problem is Angel's really smart. So he very quickly revolutionizes the drug game. And so not only does he get a percent of all the earnings, but he's getting like thousands of dollars. He's making truly millions of dollars in cash. At one point, Angel owns 47 cars.
That's too many cars.
We had a unique way of setting up shop. We took over an abandoned building and closed all the windows with concrete. All the doorways were always closed with concrete. Every day we would break this one concrete wall to get in. It would take like 30, 40 minutes. Then we'd send in one of our crew. He'd have enough food and drink to last him the entire day. Then we would lock our guy in there with cement, except for a tiny hole we'd leave. He would sell to people through the peephole. Our spot was like Fort Knox. That way, they never had to actually deal with drug addicts coming for the rest of the drugs. And if the police wanted to get in, it would take them 30, 40 minutes to break down the concrete. And so everybody could flush everything. Brilliant.
That is brilliant. I was fatiguing from the streets. I was disgusted by all the violence. I didn't want my people to get hurt. I didn't want to get hurt. And the truth is, I started to witness the possibilities of another better life. So he was working as his brother's number two, and they were really deep in the drug game.
But he had his other set of childhood friends who were really into music. He slowly started realizing that the life of a dealer would only end with me in jail or dead.
And some of his music friends started to like do well. They start getting on the radio. They start getting these opportunities.
And Angel eventually has this breakdown where he happens to be on vacation in Santo Domingo. And the feds come in and arrest like 40 people. He had left all of his money with a family friend in a box. And he kept calling this guy being like, can you send me more money? Can you send me more money? I obviously have to stay here. I can't go back to New York right now with everybody I know getting arrested. The guy stops answering him. He finally went over and it turned out the guy had spent all the money. So Angel starts freaking out. So now he has like no money. The government had confiscated all of his jewelry, all of his
cars.
He had nothing left. And then his $1 million in cash that his friend was watching for him is spent. So he starts kind of having a nervous breakdown. He fucked up his whole life. And of course, the police caught up to him. He did 5 years in the pen. It broke my heart.
He also eventually relapses on drugs again. He doesn't stay clean for very long, it seems like, for the rest of his life. At one point, he goes blind and still just has such a hard time kicking drugs. When in 2016, obviously, Fat Joe at that point is very successful. He tried to move his brother down to live with his parents in Miami. They were all living in Miami at that point. And his brother just didn't want it.
When you have family on drugs like that, it's perplexing. What do you do? Do you support them or cut them loose? Let them go and be on their own, even if it means they'll live in the streets and be homeless? At first, it seems obvious that the right thing to do would be to support them. But after some time, you've got to start to wonder. I've got friends who have brothers who are addicts still living in their mother's house. Either you change or I can't fuck with you. I might still love you, but I can't fuck with you. It felt like he chose drugs over everything else. Drugs are addictive and addiction is disease. I know this, but it's hard to shake the feeling that the addict in your life is being selfish, sacrificing family for the drugs. It hurts. My brother broke my heart again and again. That shit destroyed me.
I found this to be such a beautiful and honest way to write about this. I was mad too. My brother is the one guy that I looked up to as my hero in this world, and I felt he let me down. I think there are just like so many feelings involved, and you can like try your hardest and you can't change someone who doesn't want to be changed.
He also talks about the karma he feels of having made so much money selling drugs to people. He's like, it wasn't until 5 years ago that I realized that I was the cause of pain in so many people's lives. Like all of the families of the people I was selling drugs to felt the way I feel about my brother. And there have been many times, both as a little kid, as young as 14, And then to this day as Fat Joe, where he'll go with a gun to the dealers and be like, I'll kill you if you sell my brother, but none of them listen to him. And he's like, that's what I was doing. We looked at that equation as kids and saw a chance to make money and take care of ourselves and the people we loved. We had impossible choices and were too young to know better, but we jumped in with both feet. We thought we could be the ones who made the game work for us, but it destroyed my brother and a million other brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and on and on and on. The disease, the violence, the incarceration, we didn't invent any of it, but it ripped us apart. It's sad. All the guys I knew that made money off of drugs, even if they didn't go to jail, they had real tragic lives. You made your money off of people's pain. There's a price to that. And eventually he takes over caring for Angel's son, Junito.
He felt pretty much untouchable in the streets when he was in junior high and high school. He had such an intense reputation that he was like, who would ever fuck with me?
And he goes, I'm always rolling 100 deep. And I'm saying, how? There's not enough sidewalk space.
100? 100 deep?
Joe Biden doesn't roll 100 deep. And he's got like caravans.
Okay, so then one time it's the 4th of July and everyone's out in the streets. Everyone's having a nice time. He has some guns in his car, but he's with his friends playing basketball and he goes to the bodega alone.
Which is a huge mistake. If anything, you never roll with less than 50 people, even to the bodega.
Yeah, he just wanted a soda.
Mistake.
And Claire knows, karmically speaking, you can't have soda. So this guy rolls up and tries to kill him.
Okay, so he had loaned this guy $10 one time. The guy wasn't paying him back. And he's like, now I know that when someone borrows that little money, you have to look at it through like the Godfather lens of saying you basically paid $10 to never have to see that guy again. Take it as a gift. So he goes to the bodega and he sees that guy and he's like, looking back, there were signs. Like it was July 4th and he was wearing a long leather trench coat. Or it was July 4th and when I looked at him, he had evil in his eyes.
Anyway, so this kid starts trying to kill him.
And yeah, he pulls out a gun and he's like, looking back, I wish when he had pulled that gun on me, I didn't say, you're a little pussy bitch, you'll never kill me. Because the guy does, in fact, shoot him twice. He shoots at him, so Fat Joe turns to run. And as you guys know, 400 pounds, he's not quick with it.
And there's surface area to hit.
He gets shot through the back. The bullet comes out his tummy. Then he gets shot in the arm. He's running by. As I'm trying to get away from S, I got to the main street. I actually ran by my mother, who was in the middle of the street. My mom was there with my oldest son, Joey, who was just a baby. My white tee had turned dark red, covered in blood. My mother and I made eye contact as I ran past her and my child. She looked scared to death. I was more hurt from her being in pain than I was from my gunshot wounds. I just kept running. And then finally, his uncle's like, give me your car keys. I'll drive you to the hospital. And he's like, I don't want to get blood on the car. And his uncle's like, bro.
And he's like, I was losing a lot of blood and my legs felt like jelly. So I got in the car.
He's still going, though. God bless. So he gets in the car. They go to the hospital. Everybody's like, he's going to die. It doesn't look good for this guy. He's got so much bleeding. And then he goes, I was stripped down. They put me on a gurney and wheeled me into a room and they gave me, I don't know the name of it. I think it was a catheter. They put it up your dick. I was like, what the fuck? They put it in your dick. You know what it's called. It's okay to have a catheter when you get shot, Joe.
Google it. You're writing this in Google Docs, I'm sure.
So then the police bring the guy and they're like, is this who shot you? But Joey's like, I'm not going to tattle. And they're like, you're literally going to die. Is this who killed you? And he's like, I don't know. I can't remember. I don't recall. It was crowded.
And then the guy who has been beaten to a pulp is like, it was me. I did do it.
Yeah, he goes to jail. He gets life and Joe never even has to go in court. But he's like, by the time I even saw him in the hospital, he looked like the elephant man because he had gotten the shit beat out of him. He's like, before even my guys could get up on him, though, the parents of the block beat the shit out of him because they're like, how dare you be shooting near our kids?
It was the 4th of July. Everyone's hanging out outside. You can't just be shooting into a crowd of children.
The funniest part of it all is so he goes into emergency surgery. He comes out that night and for some reason he feels that his number one priority is to dispel the notion that he died. Everybody thought he had died. And he's like, so I had to go show face all over the neighborhood to let everyone know I was still alive. And I'm like, why? I can't believe Fat Joe got shot twice and was back on the street in flip-flop slides that night. He's like, at this point, he felt unstoppable. I was showing the whole Bronx I couldn't be killed. Fast forward just a few years later, I didn't feel nowhere near Superman. My brother, Tone Montana, was killed outside his house. I kept thinking if Tony, the livest, the realest that God ever created could die, then anybody could die. This was around the time a lot of our crew and a lot of dealers from different neighborhoods started getting locked up. So this is fasting forward, but Tony, I'll just tell the story of Tony Montana, his best friend. They were BFFs. They lived in the same building. At one point when they were like 12, somebody pulled a machine gun on Fat Joe and Tony goes, you got to kill me first. And Fat Joe was like, well, that's a real one. And I guess later he got shot, but Joe keeps his memory alive. I mean, it's just so much death. I can't even fathom it.
I can't at all. The amount of just like guns and violence and drugs there's someone who was out to get Fat Joe and his brother, and then that guy ended up getting shot leaving the parole office. So then he's like, I don't know what would have happened to us if that guy hadn't gotten murdered first.
So he fast forwards when everyone's getting locked up and Tony Montana got murdered. He had just signed with Relativity and his big first hit, FloJo, was out. And he says the day before, this is such a weird choice to me. The day before they were going to shoot the music video for FloJo, which was his first single, he stakes out S, the guy who shot him, at some like halfway house or something. And at 6 a.m., the guy hadn't come out yet. So he goes back to his mom's place, wakes up, the feds have him in handcuffs. Turns out they were looking for the brother and they were like, well, we were following you. Why were you outside all night? And he comes up with a lie like, oh, I thought my girlfriend was cheating on me, blah, blah, blah. But he's like, how lucky am I that that guy S never came out? Because it turns out the feds were watching me all night looking to murder this guy. And I'm like, yeah, lucky duck.
Yeah, he's like, I would have been under surveillance killing someone.
But then he's like, anyway, at 9 a.m., I had my first music video. Okay, you can't be up all night before you got to work a full day. Why would that be the night you stay up all night to kill somebody right before your big starring role?
I wonder if he was just like, I don't know, I don't want to like go into this next chapter with loose ends unloosed.
I am so anti-murder.
I don't like murder either. And I also am pro getting a good night's sleep before a shoot day.
And I don't even know which order I put those priorities in for myself. Okay. I have to be honest with you guys.
Yeah.
I really, really don't understand the music industry. And I specifically do not understand rap groups within the music industry.
Like the collectives.
I don't understand the money. I don't understand the allegiances. I don't understand. Maybe we could get someone who works at like a rep guard company on the Patreon to kind of explain the situation. Because this chapter is about DITC. I don't know what that even stands for. Digging in the crates.
Yes.
We got our name because that's exactly what we used to do. So they had Lord Finesse, Diamond D, Showbiz, and AG, OC, Buck Wild, Big L, and Fat Joe. We're a clique of icons who made number one hits, took dominion of the underground, and influenced generations of hip hop. But it all starts with Robert Hall, better known as Lord Finesse. So Lord Finesse, again, he does that thing where he like just does pages and pages in honor of him.
I knew a lot of kids who loved to rap, but outside my brush with Scorpio in the supermarket, I really didn't know anyone who started from our hood and became successful as a rapper. Finesse was Jadakiss before Jadakiss, top five dead or alive. Sometimes you got to see someone become successful before you could believe it would happen to you. So he sees Finesse kind of like going on to bigger and better things. And he's like, wait a second, should I try that?
And these are the friends that get him off the streets. He says, I know you love hip hop. Come to the studio. Use the music to tell your story. I'll do the beats. You're going to die out here, Joe. I'm telling you. Just tell your story in the music. So they go to Jazzy J's studio in the Bronx.
Yeah, Finesse and Diamond D like pay for his studio session.
But can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Jazzy J isn't Jazzy Jeff.
I don't think so.
And then do you remember in Juicy J's memoir when he was like, I wanted to be Jazzy J, but there was already a Jazzy Jeff?
Yeah, so I don't think Jazzy J got the same memo as Jazzy Jeff, unless Jazzy J is Jazzy Jeff. But I don't think it is.
Or was when Juicy J trying to be Jazzy J was like, there's already quite literally a Jazzy J.
I guess it's so hard because Jazzy J does roll off the tongue. And again, this is pre-internet. So like, I bet you there were a lot of Jazzy J's, to be honest with you.
This is why it's so important to be able to claim like an email address.
Yeah. This is why you have to get your kid on Instagram young.
That goes against quite literally everything we've ever said.
I know. I'm kidding.
Just an empty.
Just locked on the handle.
So ultimately, he was still like half in, half out. As I was getting deeper into Raps Underground, I found myself comparing it to the Dope Game. In the game, I was mentally exhausted from waking up every day, worrying about going to jail or getting killed, having to be on edge. DITC didn't have to live like that. And one by one, they were taking on the industry. They all start getting like legit deals. The problem is the music industry sees Fat Joe as just like a drug dealing gangster, which I'm not going to lie to you guys.
He was like 6 months out.
Would not want to walk down the street with him. I just think you could quite literally catch a stray.
Yeah.
I still feel that he was in danger oft. Like 10 years later, he went to kill that S. If you try to kill somebody quite literally with a gun, people remember that.
Yeah. I don't want to be in the way. My friends in the streets began to go down, but my friends in the industry began to prosper. I wanted to explore this music thing. I knew I could do it.
So he goes to the Apollo and he's like, I was the worst rapper in my group still. I was rusty, but I was doing my best. But what did he actually have?
He had hundreds deep.
Yeah, it was hundreds deep and full of confidence. Now this is a major key. And DJ Khaled voice, a major key alert. They're buddies. So I do think he stole that phrase or borrowed it. Anybody you study historically, whether it's in business and entertainment, in sports or whatever, the big winners all have that killer mentality. I believed in myself at the Apollo. Realistically, you would have never thought that a fat Puerto Rican kid could look at everyone at the Apollo and say, none of the competition stands a chance. I wasn't even that good at the time. I was still developing as an MC, learning my wordplay and how to make hit songs. But still, truthfully speaking, they had no chance. I killed it at the tryout and got my chance to compete at amateur night.
So he brings all of his buddies.
I wonder if that's why.
Well, okay, so I will say the first time, I wonder if that's why he won. But then he keeps winning. He won four nights and then he had to get retired.
Yeah, so he wins four nights in a row at the Apollo. But he says, like, he just stands out there and they can't even hear him because they were just roaring and screaming. They loved it.
So that gives him a boost in the industry.
Yeah, then he gets, like, somebody from the Video Music Box, a legendary show on the New York Public Television. Dude, all I want is a New York Public Television TV show.
I just want to be on public access so bad. I kind of figured out how, but I don't know how you can just get like a regular time slot. I don't think they really do that. But anyway, so he gets a job emceeing this show. It's ironic that my first consistent foray into the music business was as a TV show host, but that's what I did until my music career started taking off. He also writes a promo jingle for this radio show.
Wait, can I say one thing? He goes, the whole world was tuned into Video Music Box. He has a real way of exaggerating, but we love him. And people would be like, who's that Spanish kid hosting with Uncle Ralph? They got a drug dealer doing the fucking hosting. That's so funny. I mean, they did.
They did. It's true.
He's not an actor. He wasn't really like taking on other character traits.
He has this jingle that goes on this radio show. He's starting to really lay some groundwork. People are starting to realize who he is. And then finally, Relativity Records come by with like a physical contract and he signs it on top of the car and he's like, great, let's get to work.
They're like, we want to sign you. I guess he didn't get fucked over with that contract, which is nice.
Yeah.
But it was Chris Lighty. He was got to start working for Red Alert and then went to work for Russell Simmons at Rush Management. He was down with Boogie Down Productions and Zulu Nation.
He goes to tell his mom that he got signed and she has just been diagnosed with cancer.
I think she beats it because it doesn't really come up again and she's still alive to this day.
Yeah.
But he got $50,000. And even though he had had way more money in the past, he goes, this is a legit check. I just made a legit 50 grand from my talent. That's really nice.
Yeah.
So in July 27th, 1993, I released Represent under the moniker Fat Joe Da Gangsta.
He had to shoot a video for his lead single, Flojo. He had a lot of people come out to make cameos in this video.
Even he says, when you look back at the level of artists making cameos and co-signing my first video, it's pretty wild. They helped make the single and video a big deal.
My celebrity started to grow a little after that. People started going crazy for me, but I never thought the fans I started to gain would cost me the friends I'd known and loved my entire life. So, of course, as he gets more successful, he starts losing people.
It's what he later coins as jealous one's envy syndrome. Half of his friends were happy for him, but half of them just weren't happy for me. They actually looked mad. I couldn't believe it because I loved them and I would have done anything in the world for them. It hurt me to my core. That was a whole new day for me.
He goes to LA to promote his album and he like goes to sit in the audience at the Arsenio Hall show. But then Arsenio knows he's in the audience and like calls him up to perform. And it's this huge moment that he like cancels the rest of his promo tour and he wants to go back to New York to celebrate because he's like, I just did the Arsenio Hall show. He also is scared of flying. So he like drives 4 days back to New York to celebrate with his boys.
That is a hard amount of time to keep the momentum up for.
Yeah, I really do think that after like 8 hours, I think is max I've got.
I literally am like, what could make me so happy that 4 days of a car, I'd show up like still excited. There isn't a lot. Flojo went number one. But if you listen to it now, the truth is I wasn't really that nice. Go ahead, put it on. The raps are very basic. Bust it. Check it. Watch how I wreck it.
And then he finds out about Nas and he is like, holy shit, this guy is leveling up everybody because if you can't keep up with Nas, you got to get the fuck out of the game.
But who could keep out with Nas?
Nobody. I had to step my lyrics up to another level. Anybody who kept rapping like I was on Flojo, they were out of the game or headed out.
Now he has better rhymes like hustling is the key to success. Money is the key to sex. The life is getting cash, drinking mo, getting blessed. The games people play, the names people slay. It's just another ordinary day.
So he gets on this song called I Shot Ya.
By none other than LL Cool J.
He loves LL Cool J.
Okay, what's that song LL Cool J does with J-Lo? Because that's like one of my favorite music videos.
Oh, I know it, but I forgot it.
So what? I cheated on you. That's not a big deal. It's snowing and you're so cute, J-Lo.
I know, that's it's the one where she has the earmuffs on.
Yeah,
but I like can't remember what it's called. All I have is all I am. pride is what you have.
No, pride is what you had, baby girl. I'm what you have. Which even in the seventh grade, I remember being like, I don't know if that's what you want your boyfriend to say to you. Like, why can't
you? Be easy. Don't make decisions when you're mad.
Yeah.
The path you chose to run alone.
I remember thinking to tell someone pride is what you had, baby girl, and what you have is like
crazy.
Really manipulative. I don't even think I had the language for it at the time, but I just remember being like, I don't think you should have to give up your pride in a relationship. I don't think you should be like, and in this relationship, I'm nothing but shame. I'm so ashamed of the way I'm treated, but at least I have a boyfriend. But God, they were so cute in that soft, soft snow.
They were
She's
so cute.
Beautiful. I will say, J-Lo is never directly mentioned in this book, really.
I think there's like one part where he says...
It was supposed to be J-Lo.
Yeah.
How humiliating that J-Lo's like, this is Fat Joe, my best friend. And he's like, this is J-Lo, the girl I picked beneath Ashanti.
Ooh.
Okay, anyway, we'll get there. So he gets to be on this LL Cool J song. LL was a bona fide superstar. It was a big moment for me and I couldn't wait to do it, but I had to confer with my team first and everybody's like, yeah, do it.
I think a couple of people say don't do it and he was like, it's LL Cool J, of course I'm going to do it.
They actually say, we really don't rock with other rappers.
Which they're wrong, but it's funny that he's like, I wasn't going to do it without talking to my team. So I talked to my team and they said, don't. So I did.
I respect that though.
Me too.
And then he talks about like the authenticity of having murdered and been murdered. Some of these guys were soft. Him and Showbiz had the same block authenticity. Show was the only other rapper in DITC that came from hustling in the streets. I love that he's like, they told me I was a bitch for like working with somebody else, but have they ever shot someone? I'm like, is that what anybody here is talking about?
I don't think so. He gets into people being haters. He talks about how he toured with Bone Thugs and Harmony and they were so excited to get back to Cleveland. They were like, that's going to be the best show of the tour. We love Cleveland. We're so excited to get back to our hometown. And then Cleveland like was not nice to them. And he's like, wow, fuck you haters.
And then he talks about Big L, who was like an absolute brilliant rapper, and he ends up dying as well. I mean, he just knows so many people who died, and it's just so sad because so many people were so talented.
In life and death, L pushed me as much as anyone. The best rhyme I've ever written was because of L.
And then he talks about his friend, my man, Omar O.C. Creddle. I mean, he just talks about all these people he loves. I'm with DITC all the way. It's my dream to become financially stable enough to get some type of situation for all my brothers. And they're not doing bad. Don't take it as charity. But it's been a goal of mine to make $100 million and situate my guys on another level, which I like really respect. I really do think Fat Joe is a deeply loyal man who wants to be able to take care of everybody and he takes care of his family. And I like really respect that about him. But then he says this, which made me laugh. He goes, what do you want to do? You want to go to McDonald's? Let's rock. You want to go to the movies? Cool. I haven't been able to do it yet. My whole life, yeah, I've been successful, but there's been ups and downs, a roller coaster. When the day comes that I'm financially secure at the right level and I can say to myself, yo, Joe, you good? It's my dream to make a U-turn, go back to them and be like, yo, let's do whatever you want to do. Let's rock. So that I want to say,
you can't go to the movies?
McDonald's. I got enough money to take your friends to McDonald's. Call up Big L. Call up OC. I'll take everyone to McDonald's. I mean, the movies these days is a stretch. You know, it has to be like a birthday or something, but I could take everyone to the movies too, I think. I just need to like...
Budget for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that just has to be like my splurge of the month. But McDonald's.
We could all go to McDonald's.
I mean, could take 10 people to McDonald's.
Because of the boycott list.
Yeah.
But we could.
But we could. Financially.
Financially. I was still hanging out in the hood. Nobody gave me the memo. You're not supposed to be in the projects no more. And then he meets Big Pun.
Christopher Rios was a godsend to me. It didn't even take him 2 full years to have an unprecedented impact on hip hop in the world. His greatness was too much for us, though.
He's like going to a store and a bunch of guys come up and they're like rapping at him. And then this big Puerto Rican kid starts his verse and he says, it gave me a bone chill unlike anything I've ever felt before. I love hip hop and there's a certain feeling you get when you hear a song that's absolutely monumental. So he tells this kid, like, get in my car. And he's like, well, what about my friends? And he's like, you know what? You'll get successful and then you can put your friends on. But right now I just want you. And he starts working with Big Pun. That's kind of it. They become like attached to the hip.
He's like, the minute I met this guy, he started telling me his whole life story. He's like, I've never met somebody so honest and vulnerable. He's just 5'7", 5'8", 450 pounds, like literally a kid, just rapping at him and being like, anyway, I grew up and it was tough. Like, he's such a funny guy. He's a real goof. He was already married to his wife, Lisa. They had met as young teenagers, gotten married the minute he turned 18 at the courthouse.
She was 17.
They were homeless, couch surfing, because he had left his parents' house for the similar reasons to Fat Joe. But he had a rich uncle who owned a factory and he went and asked for a job or money or something. And the uncle goes, eat rocks and hands him pebbles. Can you fucking believe? The problem is, when Pun turned 18, his family lawyer got a hold of him and informed him that he won $500,000. He had gotten hurt when he was like 4 or 5 at a city playground because of negligence, so he won it. And apparently he went from being 180 pounds and could have actually been a GQ model to he stopped walking, he stopped being active, and they started eating out constantly.
He just like spent his whole lawyer winnings on snacks.
But immediately he like drives him right to the studio and puts him on 2 of the songs of Fat Joe's next album. And then he just goes on about like what a huge impact he had on everybody.
They called each other twin.
It was really cute. This is what I was talking about where I don't really understand what's going on financially. People don't believe me, but I probably never got no real money with Big Pun directly. Indirectly, because of my success with Big Pun as an artist, I was later able to go to Atlantic Records and get a multi-million dollar deal for Terror Squad. But from Pun personally, he refused to let me make a dollar. Loud gave me a $100,000 check for Pun when we finalized the deal weeks later. I don't even understand why you would get money because you met this kid at a bodega. But anyway, as soon as he got $100,000 for Pun, he was like, you know, I've been looking at this watch. And he made him go buy him a watch that was $105,000. So they did Twins, Deep Cover 98. He said he was just so funny. Pun said his most iconic lines ever on that record too. Dead in the middle of Little Italy, little did we know that we riddled two middlemen who didn't do diddly. That's such a fun thing to say. They were like, he was just a jovial dude who loved tongue twisters.
They were always laughing. He said they laughed their little butts off together.
And that him and Biggie were actually going to do a record together. And he had called to set it up. And then 2 days after that phone call, Biggie was murdered.
Pun became the first ever Latino solo MC to go platinum. Just like that, Pun was a superstar.
He was working with Wyclef Jean. He was crazy just spending the money. He was like, he spent it like there was no tomorrow.
I guess there kind of wasn't.
Yeah, but he still had a family and a kid.
True.
Big Pun met Remy Ma. He brought her into the fold. They all knew she was going to be a star too.
Yeah, he was like, oh my God, you found this girl's amazing. And then Pun was like, she's our girl. And I was like, okay.
I'm not a player and don't want to be a player. Still not a player.
Don't want to be a player no more.
When we started getting into these songs, I was like, ugh, my childhood. These were the songs that I bump and grinded to at every bat mitzvah up the East Coast.
This was our happiest point. I was selling Pun was out of here on another planet. His group was rapping with him. We met. We folded them into the Terror Squad along with my bro. Everything was panning out. It was like we were catapulting ourselves into a serious empire.
They start getting into a lot of trouble. That's what's weird is they're now very famous. They're making a ton of money, but they're still acting the way they always acted. They're still in the Bronx. And he says he started realizing that people would get into physical altercations with him in order to then sue him later, which was a problem he had to pick up on. Pun, however, was not doing well. He got up to 600 pounds and then 700 pounds. He eventually went to like a weight loss camp in North Carolina, but eventually he died. And he's like, we just didn't know back then that it was bad to be 700 pounds. He's like, if I had known, I would have stopped it. He also was like, I was not in a position to tell him he had to lose weight because I was like also struggling with my weight. So he dies in February 11, 2000.
Yeah, he died like a year after Biggie, I think. So at Big Pun's funeral, they also have a couple people, like Big Pun's uncle, the one who told him to eat rocks, came to the funeral and they kicked him out. And Fat Joe says, this is one of the most relatable things I've ever read in my life. One of my biggest fears is that I die and my friends or family let the wrong people come to the funeral.
Why would that be your fear? As long as I'm alive, you know I'm bouncing.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying is I always think about that. Anyway, so this begins a downward spiral where his sister, Big Pun, and his grandfather, a lot of people who are very close to him, die very quickly.
I was going through one of the toughest stretches of my life. I was in a depression. Not only was Pun gone, but my sister and grandfather had passed as well. While I was down, a lot of people acted like I was dead too. I heard people I counted as some of my best friends saying I was going back to the projects. I was going to fall off. I couldn't do it again. Some fans and music journalists echoed the sentiment. That really hurt me, but it also fueled me to work. So at Big Pun's funeral, at one point at the end, Fat Joe had been sitting in the corner crying. And Ja Rule, who had never met him before, came over and was like, hey man, like, I'm really sorry for your loss. And Fat Joe really appreciated that. 4 months later, out of the blue, Irv Gotti and Ja Rule call him up and they're like, get down to the studio. We have a song for you. It's 4 a.m. He grabs his wife, which I love. I mean, I would hate for Mac to wake me up at 4 a.m., but if he was a rapper going to the studio, I would be like, yes, I should be there.
Yeah.
I like in this situation, the respect. So they go down to the studio and they play him the song and he goes, holy shit, that's a hit. No one's ever just handed me a hit on a plate. The song, What's Love?
So this is a moment where he is down and out. He hasn't had a hit in a minute. He's just sad. And Ashanti is on the record. And they're like, okay, so this is a placeholder, but we're going to get this girl, J-Lo. And he goes, no.
Because J-Lo has just worked with Ja Rule on the I'm Real remix, which, sorry, but I love. I guess I'm Ashanti's biggest fan because these are all my favorite songs.
Leave the girl on there, man, I insisted. That's how What's Love came about. We put it on my album, Jealous Ones Still Envy, which dropped December 4th, 2001.
What's Love went all the way to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. From that point on, I stuck with Murder, Inc. at the hip.
He talks a lot about how he's like a big loyalty guy. Once you're there. Like, he is like glue.
So it's 2002. Ashanti drops her self-titled debut solo album. It's Through the Roof. I didn't realize how big she was at the time.
Yeah.
I guess because at this point, I would have been 10. I guess I had never realized how hot she was for that point. But I do love all these friggin' songs. And he starts talking about mixtapes, which are unofficial releases that aren't sanctioned by record labels. It's really important for self-promotion. If people hear you on the mixtapes and they start playing at the clubs, it means you're going to be a hit. At this point, you may have heard a young gentleman by the name of 50 Cent.
So 50 Cent hates Murder, Inc. And because of Fat Joe's now...
Oh, wait. I know you said Murder, Inc. I just wanted to confirm. Murder, Inc. He doesn't hate Murder, Inc.
Oh, no. He loves Murder,
Inc. I think
Inc.
It's important to know, much like Fat Joe, 50 Cent is a man of a violent world.
Yes. Loves murdering, hates Murder, Inc. So 50 Cent has this kind of beef with Murder, Inc.
Very tricky, like how my dad loves yoga but hates yogurt.
Because of Fat Joe's now association with Murder, Inc. and the fact that now he is ride or die for Murder, Inc., 50 Cent hates him.
Yeah, so they start this beef that's insane. And 50 Cent...
It cost him like millions of dollars in sponsorships. He had this deal with Jordan Brand fall through. That would have been like $20 million.
So basically what happened is Ja Rule is kind of soft. And I guess he sings and stuff. And 50 Cent is like, I'll get shot every day. And everybody's like, oof. He's got a point, Ja, you're a little bitch. But Fat Joe's like, I can't turn my back on Ja. Like, where's Ja? He helped him. Actually, in a crisis, it turns out you do want Ja on your side. So he sticks around.
Keep going. I'm listening.
But now 50 Cent is against everyone who's on his team. 50 Cent is like mean, okay? He found a photo of Fat Joe and his wife at the beach and used it for the cover art for his album called Elephants in the Sand. And he's like, that's my wife, man. This is too mean. As Ashley says, it gets to the point where like they're at MTV and police are getting involved. People are literally scared of what will happen if these two men cross paths. At one point he goes, listen, if we had bumped into each other at a Starbucks, people in that Starbucks were going to get hurt. That's how bad it was.
Everybody turned their backs on Ja Rule and Murder, Inc. except me. I was the only one. And that's when my beef with 50 Cent started. He says now they're great friends. I knew there was a strong possibility someone would get hurt with all of us in the crowd. I didn't want to disrespect MTV because they always showed me love. I didn't want to disrespect hip hop, but it's like boiling over.
So they finally make up because that guy, Chris Lighty, the one who signed him to his first ever record deal, dies by seemingly self-inflicted wound. I'm not sure what happened. He's like, I didn't see it coming, but also we don't talk about mental health in hip hop, so anything could be true. They go to the funeral. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody comes with an entourage. They see each other. They ignore each other. Then they're on like a
tribute show.
50 Cent comes up to him in the middle of rehearsal and puts his hand out and says, peace.
50 left his hand out for damn near a minute without me grabbing it. I just looked at him. Is he for real? I thought. I had all this anger built up. We'd been beefing for 8 years. The only outcome I'd ever seen to this kind of beef was violence. So when he said peace, I couldn't believe it. Peace? I asked him reluctantly. Yeah, peace for Chris Lighty, Fiff repeated. He wanted peace. I shook his hand. He has a lot of movie references. He considers himself a movie buff, but he's like, is constantly trying to explore emotion by like telling you about a movie scene. So he says, you remember when The Wizard of Oz, when they said, ding dong, the witch is dead, the wicked witch is dead? That's how people were merrily shouting about me and 50's beef ending. I love his movies.
People ran on stage in the moment hugging us. Not just rappers. Regular industry insiders were coming up there hugging us, faces beaming with joy. They were like, oh my God, it's peace. Thank God.
And then they just all start hanging out. Me, my wife, 50, and his girl. They like have birthday parties together.
Yeah, he's like, a few years later, I'm throwing him a birthday. I'm a mega yacht, cutting his cake, singing happy birthday, 50 Cent.
Because their beef was about nothing. Their beef was about association to Murder,
He really
Inc.
was like, when I think about it, I don't even really know what we were fighting about. You learn to respect each other from beefing. 50 once told me, I get along with you more than guys I've known for years, more than guys I grew up with. We have a brotherhood built on mutual respect. I don't think he ever wants to lose that, and neither do I. G-Unit and Terror Squad, it's going down. That being said, a lot of people were like, are you fucking kidding me? I think that's the hardest part of having a beef and having a crew is when you take on other people's beef and then they say, we've made up. And you said, well, what am I supposed to do with all this hate in my heart?
I mean, that's kind of what happened to him, though, because he didn't have a problem with 50 Cent. He took up the beef because of Ja.
Yeah, he's like, when he stuck his hand out, I was thinking about all the things he said about my wife, all the times he dissed me on the radio.
Okay, just real quick in the middle of this, I just took a moment to watch All I Have with LL Cool J and J-Lo. And I have to say, it is a perfect music video. It's so good. She's just as cute as ever.
I can't believe that they wrote like a cheater's anthem. It's so manipulative.
And the video is like the rom-com we deserve. Okay, I have so many things to say. We're going to talk about it on the Patreon this week. I think this week on the Patreon, we have to do like a walkthrough all of these 2000s hits. Lean Back, okay. I'm Real, All My Love. Like all those songs we have to look at and watch the videos. LL Cool J is such a good actor. He does these asides in that song where he goes, every time she starts like explaining why she's upset that she got cheated on and is going to move out, he goes, oh boy. And like rolls his eyes. He's like, come on. And then he gets slowly more and more exasperated and pissed off that she like dares
to not want to be cheated on.
And he's like, come on. And by the end, he's like, so pissed off. And I'm like, that is so good acting. Cause that's true. They start out like, sorry. And then they're like, really? Really? You're not going to let me do whatever I want and get away with it? Okay, bitch. It's so good. She's so beautiful in it. It's worth the watch.
Okay, so now we get to the point of this book where he like re-explains what the terror squad is.
We are now, yeah, we are at the section of this book that I call the Q&A. It's a lot like the Gracie Gold book in that he has about 75% narrative. And then suddenly he's like, all right, let me go in depth at just some topics. So now we're in like the topic heavy.
Yeah, there's like a little bit more story coming, but it's mostly topics from here on out.
So he's like, what is the terror squad? And I'm like, I know, I read the book.
You already told us.
So innocently enough, it started out as the graffiti crew. And then eventually when we got too old for graffiti, we started robbing banks and robbing people. And then it became
a rap crew. So the Terror Squad part two, this is where he introduces Scott Storch, which we have deep dived about on. We did Troy McKeady's former podcast Dunzo about Scott Storch.
Can I say, I really think that's also worth doing another Patreon about.
Me too. I think we got to go in on Scott Storch again. So
and we'll
he
see
was
if we can get Troy for it because Scott Storch is behind a lot of Britney Spears music. True.
Yeah. He was a big producer, a very talented music producer.
Like one of the biggest in America, the world. And then just
spent bazillions of dollars on like private planes. Like not even 47 cars, but like he just kept buying planes.
And drugs.
And drugs. I don't think you buy a fuck ton of planes unless you're on drugs.
We kept coming back every year with smashes, Get It Poppin' in 05, Make It Rain in 06, but then everything crashed. Scotty was squandering millions on drugs and then he was just off the map. My greatest collaborator couldn't make music anymore. He later says like, oh, in Miami, I hang out with DJ Khaled. I hang out with this person. I hang out with Scott Storch. And I'm like, wait.
Are you still hanging out with Scott Storch?
Is he back? Where is he? But that is a really interesting topic. I really think we have to do like a music of our childhood Patreon.
Yeah. Okay. So then he talks about turning 40 years old and being kind of depressed about how he felt like his career had petered off because like Scott was gone. Like all this shit was messed up. And Dre came over and goes, like, you had to get back in the studio. And he goes, no, no one wants to hear a 40-year-old rapper. And Dre goes, Tina Turner dropped her first solo hit at age 44. What's love got to do with it? Are you kidding me? So then he puts out another album. What a beautiful, inspiring story.
Tina Turner, excellent top tier memoirist alert. And then he says, okay, this is actually a really sad story. This is about his sister, Lisa. For most of my teenage years, I pretty much was known as a villain throughout my neighborhood in the Bronx, rightfully so in a lot of instances. But when it came to my sister, Lisa, I always saw myself as a hero. He always prided himself in taking care of her. What happened is she had a son. And then when she went to have another baby,
there was like malpractice when she was delivering.
They gave her the epidural wrong. The baby died and she became brain dead. And she was in a coma for 8 months until finally she passed away.
It was fully ruled medical malpractice. The hospital where my sister went to deliver the baby was negligent in her death. We sued and won a multi-million dollar lawsuit. In the transcripts, it actually says the doctor killed Lisa Marie Cartagena.
Killed. I couldn't believe it when I was reading the paperwork, but it happens all the time to black and brown women giving birth in these hospitals in their own neighborhoods. There are uncaring medical professionals, sometimes inexperienced, sometimes incompetent, who treat these women almost like guinea pigs. So they end up winning $2 million. He says that he was like when his friend Tone got murdered, it was hard on me. But when Lisa passed, it was a thunderstorm of death like you wouldn't believe. I had to go to a therapist for help. John, the surviving son, is awarded $2 million and the family does everything they can for him by putting it into like a trust that he can't touch till he's 18. And they even figure it out to make sure he only gets a little bit at a time. So he'd get it at like 18, 21. And then a few years later.
But when he turns 18, he figures out how to get all of it.
You know, those like cat give me my money now or like it's my money and I want it now ads, which are predatory. So he got all the money now. So I fucked up there. If I'd been smarter, I would have managed that money. I didn't do it. I wasn't as hands-on as I should have been for my nephew because he was scared that people were going to be like, oh, Joe's stealing from him. I've been surrounded by death my entire life, and it's not accidental. I grew up in a racist, predatory system, and that system will feast on you. The system took my sister. The system stole my nephew's money. The system has pirated multiple members of my family and friends. The vultures will leave you alone and broke or dead. You can never stop fighting, and you have to keep your guard up at all times.
Ugh, it's really sad.
And he's like, I hope that John, who's still in his early 30s, has time to get focused and fix his life. But I don't know. That's like such a sad story.
Yeah. So then he gets into the story of his two sons. So when he was very young, he had his first son who was born with Down syndrome. And eventually they found out he was also autistic. And the mom, as soon as Joey was born, dipped.
Yeah. She was like, I don't want this kid. I'm putting it up for adoption. And so his parents took it in and raised him. So he hates her. And then his second son, he liked that woman better. It just didn't work out. It seems like they tried to make it work for a while. He worries about that son, though, because he says even though he went to an expensive college and is so smart, he wants to be a rapper. And Fat Joe does not want him to be a rapper. He's like, I think it's too hard for like the kids of rappers because they didn't grow up in the projects. They didn't go through it. And they're always going to be compared to their dad. He's like, he's just so smart. I wish he would be a business person. And then he says, maybe it's my fault for putting too much on my kid. If my father gets sick, I'm the only one who's in the hospital. He's got 12 sons and daughters. If he's there for 3 days, I'm there for 3 days. If my mother gets sick, I'm the only one to hold her down. My brother's Angel's blind and we don't know where her other son is. My sister is dead.
Sorry, that never gets mentioned anywhere that Raymond's just like missing.
I just felt so bad for the mom. Can you imagine 3 kids? One's missing, one's blind, one's dead.
One's Fat Joe. That's nice.
So for this entire immediate family and friends and extended family, it ain't on nobody else's shoulder. The buck stops here. With Ryan growing up, I was trying to prepare him for that. You're going to have to take over. If somebody does this or that, you got to move this way. And he would say, your brother's autistic. If I die tomorrow, it's on you. I'm going to leave you money. You have to make sure that that kid never goes to a home. He could never be with other people. He has to be happy and cared for in this family. That's a big responsibility. So I don't know. He's just like, well, I hope he is happy creating a path.
Yeah. And then we get to his daughter's chapter. Well, he does his wife and his daughter in one chapter, but he loves his daughter so much more.
Yeah. So he met his wife, Lorena, when they were like young. She was 19 or something.
Yeah. And he
had never seen an ass that big.
He hadn't put out a full record yet, I don't think. He wasn't very successful yet. She had more money than him, he said, but he had never seen an ass that fat.
He can't get over it. And then she actually was Colombian and from Queens. He's like, we had never met Colombian people before.
Yeah.
But her dad was a big coke dealer. He ended up going to jail. They just like were there for each other. And he's like, when people ask, how do you keep a marriage going? They've been together for 30 years now. He says, we just agreed. We just said, this is the last stop on the train. No matter what, we work it out.
Can I tell another one of his movie comparisons?
This one is so funny. Yeah.
He's like really trying to convey the gravity of his emotion. So at one point they're trying to get into this club. Fat Joe doesn't get into the club because they're at capacity. And she turns around and sees that he doesn't get in. So she comes back out to be with him. This was our moment. I grabbed her hand. We ran down the block. I'll never forget. She had on these tight leggings. That ass was so fat. I started running with her. Like, you ever see Little House on the Prairie when Melissa Gilbert and her sisters in the show were so gleeful running across that big fucking field of wildflowers in the opening credits? It was like that. Damn near skipping with her.
So they stay together. And then he has his daughter. She's 16. He loves her so much. It's so funny because he's just like, private school, man. It's so expensive.
He's like, how do all these other rappers have 6 kids? How can they afford that much private school?
Yeah, he's like, that's 300 grand in just 1 year of private school. And he believes, he goes, it's like that thing in Islam where you can have 4 wives if you keep them all in the same lifestyle. He goes, I knew I couldn't afford to keep that many more kids in private school. So
yeah,
I only have 3.
He also says that he is very careful because his first son was born with special needs. He was like, I understood the gravity of parenting, I think, a lot more than other people do. Not that he was afraid of having more kids who had similar challenges, but he was like, you can't just have kids and send them on their way. Sometimes you have kids that like you need to parent really hard.
So at this point, I thought I was done with the book. Essentially, it was just like little chapters being like, and another person I know, and another person
but
I know.
But then he goes to jail.
And then he goes, let's rewind. In 2013, I hit rock bottom. My career life derailed. I found out I'd been robbed of millions and I went to jail. And I was like, oh, what? Why is this just the slowest side at the end?
So he has this accountant who's been robbing him, and all of the money he's been sending this accountant, the accountant has just been embezzling, which means he has not paid taxes in 2 years. He hasn't paid any of his bills. He hasn't paid for anything. And so he goes to jail, which how could that be legal?
And he's like, I went to the feds and said, look, I paid all the money to my accountant and he didn't pay it. He stole from me millions. And they said, I was responsible for who I hire. Even though they knew that the guy robbed me, they locked me up. Can you believe that shit? Can I tell you who would believe it?
Mike, the situation.
Yeah. And also me, because I believe. I'm so scared.
I'm so scared.
I said to Ashley, I go, where's your dad at on taxes?
Well, we paid our physical. Like, we sent the check to the the guy.
I know, but I want to make sure I sent enough because he was surprised that they sent him to jail.
I was surprised they sent him to jail.
What if I'm like $4,000 wrong and they put me in jail?
Dude, if they put you in jail, I'd be so sad.
I'm kind of the Fat Joe of podcasting, and I'm kind of the Mike the Situation of stand-up comedy.
The realest one out there and the best abs in the game. They're kind of a situation.
So anyway, he has to go to jail.
For 4 months. And he keeps on kind of vacillating between trying to be like humble and keeping his head down and also having this like hood pride thing where he's like, I can't not run the place.
So Wheezy F Baby, you may know him. He had to be at jail at 7:30, and before he got there, Wheezy called him, which I love the idea of Wheezy either being a morning person or just setting an alarm.
To be like, I gotta catch Joe on his way in.
Because that's one of those things that you mean to do for a few weeks, and then you're like, fuck, I've literally got an hour left to kill this thing. So he calls me, he's just like, the one piece of advice I have for you is stay humble. And so he goes in and immediately is like the least humble dude there. And exactly as Ashley says, he's like, I didn't want special treatment. I'm not Fat Joe. I'm regular Joe.
And he's like, anyway, chicken was only on Thursdays, but I always had like 10 chickens a day.
He's like, I went in and I said, that's my bunk. And he took the bunk bed. And then he's like, I got a chef moved in. I was eating real eggs. I was eating real chicken. He had like Louis Vuitton slippers. Ew. They were eating like clam spaghetti. What's that called?
A linguine with clams in his dorm.
And he goes, you may say, where'd we get those clams from? Because obviously the inmates eat shit food. He goes, the jailers actually have a separate kitchen with much better food. And I say, Fat Joe.
How good could the clams in prison be?
For anybody. Why would that even be on the menu? Why would a jailer want clam soup?
I personally don't even want it now, and I'm not in jail.
I saw a TikTok video the other day of how they get razor clams, and I said, those are fucking worms.
Dude, I stopped eating clams when I found out about that flesh-eating virus.
I actually upped my clam eating because I won't be kowtowed into fear by TikTok. I hate that shit.
I love that shit. I say, wherever I can get a flesh-eating virus, I won't touch it.
No, I say, stop acting like that. It's perfectly fine. People every day survive, and I'm tired.
People every day survive until they're the person who don't.
Okay, but still, I'll take my chances. I feel like I'm much worse off in a car. I just like, I'm so sick of everyone saying I'm gonna die. I just had a Pop-Tart. You're telling me a clam is worse than a Pop-Tart?
Yeah.
Well, then kill me. Anyway, he gets out of jail, no problemo.
He does just do a smooth 4 months. They wanted to lock him down for way longer.
But then he comes out and guess what? Another one of his friends has been stealing from him for years and he's like down to nothing. And he says, I was down to my last couple hundred grand. He goes, I know that to you sounds rich because he's assuming we're poor. And I say,
you're right.
And he's like, when you have the overhead, I do. And he's like, listen, I support literally everybody. I support all three of my kids. I support my parents. I support my brothers. I support my brother. I'm like, yeah, he does have a lot of people he supports. So then also, if you roll with him, if he gets a Lamborghini, you get a Lamborghini.
He's like Elvis, but not mean.
Yeah.
It turns out one of his best friends in the world, who's been by his side like glue for years and years and years, was just skimming tens of thousands of dollars off the top for decades. They went back 2 years and found a couple hundred thousand dollars that had been skimmed. So he's like, I don't know, if you went back over the years, it could have been millions. And so he confronts his friend about it. He doesn't even confront him fully. He takes him aside and is like, there's a lot of money missing. And his friend goes white as a sheet. And he like starts convulsing. He's so sad that his friend would betray him like that. The thing is, every time someone betrays him, they'll always be like, don't kill me. And he's like, kill you? I'm just actually sad.
He's also always like, I know your mother and I couldn't put her through that.
Yeah.
There's a couple of people he didn't kill because he's like, at the end of the day, their moms were my friends. Okay. I would like to put forth the Danny Trejo question of, there's no murder in this book.
But was there murder?
Do you think he ever killed anybody?
I mean, he was waving guns around a lot.
He like ran the block. He was like the head of the crack game in the Bronx during the crack epidemic at 14.
I guess even if it wasn't by his hand, I'm sure he nudged some bullets. He has spent years trying to figure out what happened here. Was it greed? Did he have a complete sense of entitlement over my money? Was he harboring resentment and jealousy for decades? I'll never know. But the way he reacts to these betrayals, like, he just loves his best friends. And I don't think that people understand that just because he's a tried and true gangster doesn't mean he, like, didn't just think of them as palios. He wasn't like out there for business. He was out there for companionship. He like loves hanging out with his buddies.
And that way he's us for real, for real.
For real. I don't roll Claire deep because I like need protection. I love chatting. And if you betrayed me, I wouldn't kill you. I would be like so sad that who would I chat with?
And when I buy a Lamborghini, you always get a Lamborghini.
Exactly.
So why would you steal from me when I give you everything I have?
Exactly.
50%. I think his kids were going to private school too.
So then he talks about Remy Ma.
He was so jealous of Big Pun because Big Pun discovered Remy Ma and he was like, oh, she's so great. But then Big Pun was like, you can know her too. And he was like, awesome.
When Pun died, me and Rem had to comfort each other. We both had a bit of fear, a bit of depression settling in. But even with Pun gone, I stood with her and told her, I got your back. They went on tour. They got really tight. They're like brother, sister.
She was awesome. She was kind of crazy. When he recorded Lean Back, it was supposed to be a solo record. And then she went into the studio and was like, no, put me on it. And the producers were like, uh-oh. And then he listened to it. He like found out what happened and was like, oh, that's okay. It's way better now.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
One of the most important lines to me in music.
Yeah.
Is when she goes, we don't play admission and the bouncers don't check us and we walk around metal detectors. And she does that little thing in the music video with her fingers. I don't know if it was because in a post 9/11 world, the idea of walking around a metal detector was like the ultimate sign of freedom and success. But it's like so soothing to me. I hate it when people are like, it scratches an itch in my brain. But there is something about it that I'm just like, I could listen to that two lines on repeat for the rest of my life. Like those two lines are the height of the happiest I ever was in middle school.
If you told me you had an itchy brain, I'd believe you.
I just have dandruff. Leave me alone. I mean, Lean Back.
It's great.
I couldn't believe it wasn't the number one song in the world for a decade. To me, that's how important it was.
If you told me right now that it was, I would believe you.
We just read that it wasn't.
So then Remy Ma is doing her first solo album and it just doesn't go well. It just doesn't sell as big as she wanted it to. And she like kind of blamed Fat Joe. And so they didn't talk for years and years and years. And he says, sometimes feelings hurt more than bullets. When your soul is hurt, it hits harder than anything else. So then she goes to jail and she's away for like 6 years.
It seems like she kind of like lost it.
Yeah.
She went to jail for an attempted murder with her friend who stole $3,000. I could tell he was like, $3,000? You don't go to jail for $3,000. And he was like, I would have told her, even if the gun went off by accident, you got a girl saying you did it. Cop out. Nobody was smart enough to force her to cop out. She pleaded not guilty. And for the record, Remy maintains her innocence.
So she's about to get out of jail and she just calls him and says, I love you. I'm stupid. I was wild and I was crazy. You're my brother. And that was it. The beef melted.
When Rem got out of jail, I had to get her back into the right frame of mind to make music. She does Love and Hip Hop, and her and Papoose embody the term black love. He says, good for them.
Then they do All the Way Up. It should have won some Grammys, but it didn't. That's actually crazy. It totally should have.
DJ Khaled
is like just his best friend. They love each other.
According to him, all of his success came from that one time on Snapchat that he got lost on a jet ski. And I went, that can't be true. But also I was like, but I know exactly what he's talking about. And I'm so aware of that moment. Is that really when he became a social media sensation?
I guess
it is true.
He's like, he was just like an MC. And then he was like
lost on a jet ski and everything changed.
Yeah. I guess if I could give anyone some career advice, it would be to take your jet skis off course.
So they live next door to each other and he's like, we hang out every day. We like just walk over to each other's houses. I'm always having lunch or dinner with him. He's having lunch or dinner with me, our friends or family. Like we all just hang out. And I'm like, oh, how does it feel to live my dream?
I hope that someday we're like DJ Khaled and Fat Joe.
And Big Fat Joe. Okay, life begins at 50.
So then he talks about how now things are going really good. He got back on his feet. Him and Jay-Z are like randomly really close now, even though they were never that close before. He always thought that like aging was bad. He's like in his 20s, bad shit happened. When he turned 30, even worse. I was seriously in the doldrums after the death of my grandfather, my sister, and my other best friend, Big Pun. They all died within weeks of each other. Then I turned 40 and I just was in my feelings. Melancholy suppressed me. But then he turns 50 and he realizes rap is not a young man's game. Rap is anybody's game. You could rap at 50.
And that's what I have to do.
I had an epiphany. Life starts at 50. I reflected on my life. I thought about everything that had come my way, everything that made me who I am. I was bullied every day as a kid. Police tried to frame me. My right-hand man robbed me for 20 years. My accountant robbed me. The IRS took all my money and put me in jail. I have so many friends who are in jail or dead. I shouldn't even be here. I felt that I had cheated all these potential traps and the downfalls in my life. I celebrated my 50th birthday with Khaled in the Caribbean. He said it was just a magical birthday time. And he realized there's still time for him to become a billionaire.
But I have seen the light. I try every day to walk in the light and to shine it on others whenever I can. Just watch how I elevate during my next 50 years.
You can go through the most traumatizing shit in the world and you can fall as low as you can imagine and you can still change.
That's so beautiful.
Oh, and do you know what he works on now?
The White House.
Do you know what he's doing at the White House?
What?
He's like going in trying to get hospital transparency. Like hospitals need to tell you how much procedures cost.
That's so huge.
I know.
He also is talking about, he's like, yeah, my friend Pitbull. That's who else hangs out with them in Miami. It's like Khaled, Pitbull. And Fat Joni's like, yeah, every time I talk to Pitbull, he's buying another hospital for kids or school. And I'm like, how'd you get all this money? He goes, I learned from your mistakes. And he goes, damn, good for you.
Yeah, he says, we have to hold the healthcare system more accountable for transparency, fairness, and equity. We brought that message to the White House. That's awesome.
I can't disagree with him. And he got to star in one of the worst music video movies of all time. Wow.
But nothing can stop him. He's all the way up.
The lack of J-Lo, huh?
Notable. I also wondered, because he says he's trying to get more into like movies and acting and stuff. And I wonder if, I mean, he nailed that part.
I believed he was a therapist. I could have never believed what he had gone through.
Me either.
Ashley.
Yeah.
How dirty was this martini?
No, how fertile was the soil?
How fertile was this soil?
I would say 4.8. There was a lot going on in here.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I think it could have been organized a little bit better, but overall, the soil had nutrients.
I'm going to give it a 4.4.
Okay.
Out of 5.
And how many worm teenies would you like to have with Fat Joe?
Does Fat Joe drink?
I think a little.
Can I tell you, I would love to do like a wellness retreat with Fat Joe.
Or 5 martinis for me. I just want to hang out. Like, he seems like very serious and intense about wanting the best for the people in his life. I would love to get business advice from Fat Joe.
I kind of think if we all did karaoke together, he would totally let us do all of his songs and let us do the other parts.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he would have a problem going to karaoke and doing his own music. And I think that would be a really like fun, authentic experience for me.
Yeah. And I think that he would have a lot of fun stories. Like, if we put on people like from his crew in a positive way, then he would like tell us about like where they were when they recorded that song.
Yeah. Nothing can stop us. We're all the way up. And who is the most up?
Oh, our 5-star reviewing wormies. Thank you so much to our beautiful 5-star reviewing wormies. Thank you, Janus87. Oh my God, you're not a Jane for you. You're a Jane for us. And I'll appreciate that every single moment of every day for the rest of my life. Thank you, Fierce with 2 E's. Oh my God, too fierce for a single E. And a review too special for me to even comprehend. Thank you so much for reviewing. Thank you, Elizabeth C. Swindle. Oh, you haven't swindled me. You've given me, straight to the point, the sweetest review I've ever seen. Thank you, Mr. D-R-C-H Man W in Work. The sentence doesn't make sense to me, but the sentiment hits me right in my damn heart. Shrewdy L. Oh, there's nothing shrewd about this review. It's beautiful and it's loud and proud and I love it more than anything. Buggest fan. Oh, Bug would kiss you right back and she would wag her tail and then she would go in search of clues and it would seem like she's ignoring you, but really she's searching for a stick that is worth a review this good. Cute girl wormy. Oh my God. More like the cutest girl wormy. Thank you so much for this review. Movie lover. More like I lover this review. Thank you so much for it. That is all for this week. Thank you guys so much. I freaking love you.